Next on The Old Mole, we have Norm Diamond discussing Bloody Thursday.
Today is July 5th. It's a Monday, of course, for the Old Mole Variety Hour, but in 1934, July 5th came on a Thursday. Up and down the West Coast, we know that day as Bloody Thursday. For years before the coronavirus hit, I would spend the day at Oaks Amusement Park, part of a vast commemoration picnic with speakers, music, and free food for everyone in the park, hundreds if not a thousand or two, whether they knew about the occasion or not. At a certain point, a small group, many wearing distinctive white caps, would take a wreath down to the Willamette River, place it on the water, and set it free. Bloody Thursday is how we commemorate the 1934 Longshore Strike, one of the most formative events in Portland and West Coast history. Up and down the coast, Bloody Thursday is a holiday, with work on the docks stopped in remembrance. On that day, two strikers and a supporter were killed by police in San Francisco, setting off a chain of events that forced the Waterfront Employers Association to realize they had lost and the workers had won. Here's how Bill Bigelow and I set the stage in an essay we published in the Oregon Historical Quarterly in spring of 1988. On July 3, five truckloads of men, protected by 700 police, cruised slowly from the pier toward the warehouses. A police captain yelled, "The port is open!" The cry sparked a battle between thousands of strikers and their supporters and the police. 25 people were hospitalized. 2 days later, 5,000 people clashed with police. In what became known as Bloody Thursday, hundreds of people were injured and three were killed. The next day, California Governor Merriam dispatched the National Guard. Organized labor in San Francisco responded by calling a general strike. 130,000 workers walked off their jobs. Here's another account from California historian Fred Glass. On July 5th, what became known as Bloody Thursday, police bullets killed World War I veteran and longshoreman Howard Sperry and Marine cook Nick Bourdois a few feet from the Longshore Union Hall on Stewart Street. Their bodies lay in state in the building before being moved to the front of an enormous, silent funeral parade. Here he's quoting from the San Francisco Chronicle. The Chronicle story noted that alive, the two men wouldn't have commanded a second glance, but in death, they were borne the length of Market Street in a stupendous and reverent procession that astounded the city. Then back to Fred Glass. The discipline of the marching workers created solidarity among other crafts and trades, inspired an outpouring of sympathy in a previously wavering middle class, and scared the bejesus out of San Francisco's ruling elite. When Bill Bigelow and I wrote that Oregon Historical Quarterly piece, we were focusing primarily on what happened in Portland, how Portland workers organized their part of the strike, how they won community support, maintained morale, responded to local authority and police attacks. Here, too, strikers were assaulted and shot by police. I used to take people into Pier Park in North Portland to show them bullet holes in the trees. That's where police fired up from the railroad tracks at the park's edge while attempting to force their way by train through pickets into the Port of Portland's Terminal 4. The union that resulted from that strike's victory is the union that a couple of months ago acted in solidarity with Palestinian struggles, refusing to load a ship carrying goods to Israel. It's the union that inducted Angela Davis as a member last month on Juneteenth, joining her with Paul Robeson and Martin Luther King Jr. as its two other honorary members. It's the union that shut the Port of Portland in solidarity with the Occupy movement a few years back. It's the union that took in the workers at Powell's Bookstore on their third and successful attempt to organize. It's also the union that enabled the Portland police to form their own union, and then, years later, forced the cops to back down in a crucial confrontation. That's a story worth retelling. It was May Day in the year 2000. Like nearly every place else in the country, Portland had not had a public May Day celebration for decades. But after the invigorating WTO protests in Seattle a few months before, and the large Portland contingent that joined in, we planned to celebrate International Workers' Day on May 1st with a joyous march and some motivating speeches. The response by the Portland police was brutal, attacking, beating, and attempting to discourage us from any public action ever again. It was only the newsroom footage gathered from TV helicopters above that days later gave the lie to the mayor's and police spin on the event and showed peaceful demonstrators under vicious attack. After various town meetings and public forums, the police chief, architect of a new militarized force, had to resign. But it's one incident from that day that's the point of this particular telling. A unified march had been broken into small groups, attacked and dispersed throughout downtown. With others, including my 13-year-old and his friend, I had been driven by mounted police from the waterfront up to Powell's. We weren't prepared to fight back, but were insisting on our right to demonstrate. We were on the north side of Burnside, facing a line of armored, helmeted cops, slapping their batons threateningly into their palms, ready to charge. Just as they started towards us, 400 longshore workers, members of the union that resulted from that 1934 strike, came up behind them on Southwest 10th. Their leader spoke a few words, and the cops walked away. It turned out that leaders up and down the coast of the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, were in Portland for their annual convention. What their president, Brian McWilliams, said to the police was this. He reminded them that the Portland Police Association would not have a contract with the city if the ILWU, together with the Teamsters, hadn't shut down the Port of Portland for 3 days to force the city into negotiations. He then said, whatever the cops decided, whether they remembered that history or not, the ILWU was coming through. The cops holstered their billy clubs and left, and we celebrated May Day together with the ILWU. Next year, 2001, the City Council bought us a permit when we refused to apply for one, and we had a glorious May Day march of thousands. You can read about that 1934 strike and how it played out in Portland in the Oregon Historical Quarterly article I mentioned, or in our book, The Power in Our Hands, by Bill Bigelow and Norm Diamond. You can learn about the issues that led up to the strike and about the gains that were won. The context of the strike was the larger movement of the 1930s, the general strikes that happened elsewhere in the country also, the organizing of the unemployed and of farmers. There were major lessons the strike taught about maintaining rank-and-file activism, about enlisting community support, about the use of radio even, and about the importance of continuing militancy even after the strike was won. It was a victory that shaped our city and our region. Like all victories, it came at a cost. So today, July 5th, Bloody Thursday, I'll go down to the waterfront. All of the big strike's participants, whom I knew, are now dead, some not so long ago. I'll find a quiet spot and remember them and their struggle, and think about the struggles that came after and that continue. At some point, I'll put a little homemade wreath into the water and watch it float away. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.